Just to start off, I want to express my deep appreciation for Sansanim and for Ann Popesanim for their insights on this poem, Trust in Mind, also sometimes called Faith in Mind. I think my contribution might be a humble one. I also want to mention, today is Zen Master Jibong's birthday. He's 84. He was the guiding teacher here for many years. And to Jeff Popesanim, who passed away on July 31st. Jibong gave Inca to Jeff Popesanim, and Jeff, his history with the Sangha goes back to the very, very beginning. He kept it going for many years when it was a little bit threadbare. And after he received Inca, he scheduled and started and led the 9-day retreats, this tradition that we have now every year. That was Jeff. So I want to just say thanks to him for starting us off and keeping it together. And we have him to thank now. As for the poem, I want to start by restating some of the things that Ann Popesanim conveyed during her first talk last Saturday. Like her, I would say that this poem, which is made of words, can be made real, can be confirmed through our own experience. That is what I believe. I think Zhangbong Sansa has talked about this too. And I think it has to be this way. Otherwise, it's just an interesting poem that speaks to the Dharma in a sparkling way. But it becomes really helpful, truly helpful to us, if it inspires and helps guide our practice. So we aim to realize its teaching. Like Anne said, it's helpful to read it and digest it on one's own. So I hope you will have an opportunity to do that. I'll say a little bit more about the poem in a minute in terms of reading it and interpreting it. But like any information that comes our way, it always makes sense to approach it with an open mind, without accepting it dogmatically. We could potentially ask ourselves, is this poem telling us the truth? Is this conveying the truth? But we know that considering its ancient provenance, it's a couple thousand years old, that it is still regarded as a foundational Zen teaching. A more respectful question might be, how is this poem conveying the truth? So, we try to interpret its meaning as well as we can and understand its meaning, and then understand its meaning through our own practice. Because, again, the only possibility for answering questions about, is this true, is to experience for ourselves the Dharma to which the poem points. With these things in mind, I will say for myself that I find the teaching of this poem very inspiring and profound in the way that Zen teachings can be. Now a word about the wording. Looking into this teaching, Sansanim and Ann Popesanim and I have made use of Musong's contemporary book about this poem. The book is entitled Trust in Mind, and it was published in 2004. So in this book, the author includes 10 different translations of the poem. He relies primarily on the translation of Richard Clark, but in one of the appendices, he includes 9 other translations. He juxtaposes them sections at a time. And I looked at all of them looking for familiar wording, because there's another translation, at least one more in English. It's in the appendix of the book Zen's Chinese Heritage, which I think is downstairs. So if you pick up that book and go to the first appendix, you'll find yet another translation, number 11, that we know of. So as we go through this last section of the poem, consider that different translations inspire different interpretations and different feelings and different ideas. And here's a case in point. So on Monday, Andrew commented on the meaning of the word meaning in the poem. The line was, to return to the root is to find meaning. So we had a bit of a discussion about this word and that line, you know, and the meaning of meaning. So I thought I'd throw in just a couple other renderings of that line. The first is, return to the root and understand. Return to the root and attain the essence. So, you know, the wording really makes a difference to our ears, depending on how we interpret certain words. So I just I keep that in mind, I would like us to keep in mind, that the words in this poem are like clues or imperfect signposts that require some examination and interpretation if we are to understand in which direction we should go. What I think I'll do first now is just read through this last section before looking at each section in more detail. So just read through the last section of the poem, if I may. So starting on stanza 24, as Zen Master Jibong divided them, if the eye never sleeps, all dreams will naturally cease. If the mind makes no distinctions, the 10,000 things are as they are, of single essence. To understand the mystery of this one essence is to be released from all entanglements. When all things are seen equally, the timeless self-essence is reached. No comparisons or analogies are possible in this causeless, relationless state. Consider motion in stillness, and stillness in motion. Both movement and stillness disappear. When such dualities cease to exist, oneness itself cannot exist. To this ultimate finality, no law or description applies. For the unified mind, in accord with the way, all self-centered striving ceases. Doubts and irresolutions vanish, and life in true faith is possible. With a single stroke, we are freed from bondage. Nothing clings to us, and we hold to nothing. All is empty, clear, self-illuminating, with no exertion of the mind's power. Here, thought, feeling, knowledge, and imaginations are of no value. In this world of suchness, there is neither self nor other than self. To come directly into harmony with this reality, just say, when doubt arises, not to. In this not to, nothing is separate. Nothing is excluded. No matter when or where, enlightenment means entering this truth. And this truth is beyond extension or diminution in time or space. It is a single thought. In it, a single thought is 10,000 years. Emptiness here, emptiness there, but the infinite universe stands always before your eyes. Infinitely large and infinitely small. No difference, for definitions have vanished, and no boundaries are seen. So too with being and non-being. Don't waste time in doubts and arguments that have nothing to do with this. One thing, all things, move among and intermingle without distinction. To live in this realization is to be without anxiety about non-perfection. To live in this faith is the road to non-duality, because the non-dual is one with the trusting mind. Words, the way is beyond language. For in it there is no yesterday, no tomorrow, no today. There's a lot in this, and we're going to go through it more slowly. When I read through it superficially, and I have several times, you know, it sounds to me like pure instruction or admonition, you know. It just comes across like, this is how it is. But when I look for it, I see something else. And this has come up in our previous discussions. I see the promise of the ending of suffering. You know, he mentions this. And this is in accordance with the third of the four noble truths of Buddhism. You know, suffering comes to an end, or dukkha is seen through. Here are a few phrases that stand out for me in this poem. Released from all entanglements. Doubts and irresolutions vanish. Freed from bondage. Without anxiety about non-perfection. So this all sounds pretty good. So there is this promise in this poem. Just as Anne, Popsanim, and Zhangbong Sensei have done with their parts of the poem, I'm going to go through this last section and focus on some of the words. And keeping in mind for myself that You know, this is in translation, and we're interpreting it with our minds, you know, our thinking minds. Also keep in mind the last of the four great vows, which we say every day, you know, the Buddha way cannot be conceived with our thinking. So we aim for that. So here are some of my interpretations, along with those of Musong. Musong is the one who wrote this book, Trust in Mind. First couple of lines. If the eye never sleeps, all dreams will naturally cease. So I will just ask you, you know, what's the eye? What if the eye never sleeps? What's the eye? And what are the dream? What are dreams? All dreams will naturally cease. What's the eye? Anybody have any thoughts about that? I think so. Julie said awareness. Awareness. You know, what kind of awareness? This kind?
Just sensing. Sensing physically, of course, but there's also sensing inward, like what's happening inside. Just awareness of what's inside and out.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah.
That's E-Y-E.
Yeah, it's E-Y-E. Yeah, it's not I. It's not the letter I. If I never sleep, then I'm never going to dream.
We can't hear anyone except Paul.
Yeah, E-Y-E. So, oh, yeah, sure. Okay. So I'll do this a few times, just ask people for their views and opinions. Okay. So Julie said awareness. Thank you. Yeah, I think that's right. And I would say it is our native awareness. It is our mirror-like Buddha nature that this poem is referring to. And dreams, what do dreams represent? What does the author here mean by dreams? If the eye never sleeps, all dreams will naturally cease.
Our illusions of reality?
Yeah. Our illusions. Our delusions. Musong, who wrote the book, refers to ignorance, our ignorance. If the eye never sleeps, our dreams will naturally cease. If we're awake, residing in Buddha nature, our awareness remains unobstructed, and we naturally apprehend reality as it is. The next couple of lines make the same point. If the mind makes no discriminations, that is, if we're not dreaming, the 10,000 things are as they are of single essence. So a mind that is awake to reality makes no artificial distinctions. Now this point is made throughout this poem. To say that the 10,000 things are of single essence points to the inseparability of the one and the many, you know, the absolute and the relative. This is, again, one of the themes throughout the poem. Next, to understand the mystery of this one essence is to be released from all entanglements. And maybe I'll just ask, you know, what sort of entanglements? What comes to mind in terms of entanglements? To understand the mystery of this one essence is to be released of all entanglements. Yes, please. Thanks. Thank you, Bob. Yeah, that's great. What sort of entanglements are we released from if we penetrate into this one essence?
I don't know.
Attachments? Like our problem making in our heads? There's a word for that. I forgot.
I think that's right. We could apply a lot of words, attachments, to our sort of mistaken identification of opposites everywhere, living in this opposites world. Those sorts of things. Yeah, we can see through those and see more clearly. So being released from all entanglements That sounds really good. I think, though, that one of the key word here is mystery. So again, to understand the mystery of this one essence is to be released from all entanglements. Why mystery? It's through mystery that the inconceivable, it is through the mystery of the inconceivable that we find release and are made free, and not through conceptualization. You know, Zen Master Jibong, I remember one of his Dharma talks, he was very emphatic about this. He said, how is it that this truth of interbeing is? That wasn't the question, but he was talking about that. And then he said, it's a mystery. It's a mystery. This is why, because it's a mystery and not something we can think through and arrive at, that's why we practice letting go, including letting go of thinking, through the practice of meditation, rather than engaging in an exploration of ideas using language. So let's remember what Bodhidharma said. You know, when he was talking about this, he said, a special transmission outside of the sutras, not dependent on words. Yeah, a special transmission. Zen practice is not a philosophical practice. It's not a cognitive practice. When we talk about things and we use our minds to enter into practice, but it is meditation and the practice of gently letting go of our ideas and opinions. So to understand the mystery of this one essence is to be released. Then he writes, when all things are seen equally, the timeless self-essence is reached. No comparisons or analogies are possible in this causeless, relationless state. As I was preparing for this talk, I had the poem in my computer, and I pasted it into the beginning of my text here for the talk, and then I went through it and I highlighted in red a few parts of it that really seemed to stand out for me. And this line, no comparisons or analogies are possible, was one of the lines I highlighted, as well as the next line, which is in this causeless relationless state. So it reminds me from something I read and actually talked about 5 years ago on Huayan Buddhism and the four realms. So I was assigned during Pilche 1 year to talk about the four realms. I knew nothing about the four realms. But it turns out that the four realms were teachings from Huayan Buddhism, which is not the same thing as Zen Buddhism, and was, sort of like established about the same time or maybe a little after as this poem was written, about 2 millennia ago. Dushun was one of the four primary ancestors associated with Huayan Buddhism. And he lived in the 6th and 7th centuries, and about a generation beyond Sungsan, who wrote this poem. And he wrote about and talked about the absolute, which he called principle, or at least that's how it's translated. And this is what he said. So again, the lines from the poem are, no comparisons or analogies are possible in this causeless relationless state. Here's what Dushun wrote. This all-embracing principle is beyond comprehension of the ordinary mind and is difficult to understand. It cannot be depicted properly by means of any metaphor of this world. So he said the same thing. Sungsan, no comparisons or analogies are possible. And Dushun says, cannot be depicted properly by means of any metaphor of this world. As it turns out, Dushun then said, but I have to use a metaphor, and here it is. And the metaphor he used, anybody want to take a wild guess? It's one we hear about quite a bit. We hear of every now and then. Thich Nhat Hanh has used it. So it's very old. It's the metaphor, the analogy, of the water and the wave, or the ocean and the wave. So Dushun said the wave is entirely the ocean, and the ocean is entirely the wave, and yet here we can make these distinctions. And that is how he points at how at interbeing of, you know, the relative and the absolute. Anyway, no comparisons or analogies are possible. The point here is to underscore one more time that language and conceptualization, even very compelling analogies, take us only so far, and that the inconceivable is reached only through a direct wordless experience. And that is why we practice meditation and an inquiry using language and thought. Next section. Consider motion in stillness and stillness in motion. Both movement and stillness disappear. When such dualities cease to exist, oneness itself cannot exist. To this ultimate finality, no law or description applies. So the first couple of lines, consider motion in stillness and stillness in motion. The way that's written, it sounds like we're supposed to give some thought to motion in stillness and stillness in motion. Actually, I think it means, and I came to this conclusion reading other translations, that we should think of, or we should conceive that motion is stillness and stillness is motion. And when we do that, both movement and stillness disappear. I don't want to talk too much about these couple of lines because I've read all 10 from the book, sort of interpretations of those lines or translations. They're all a little different, but I think because I'd rather not try to make anything of those, I think that language is kind of ripe ground for thinking and ideas. But I do want to move on to the next section, which said, you know, when such dualities cease to exist, oneness itself cannot exist. This comes up later in the poem, and I'm going to talk about it tomorrow. But essentially it's saying that when you remove divisions and distinctions, you don't end up with one. We're accustomed to referring to the one. But I think these lines indicate something else. One, as an idea, as a construct, doesn't exist without at least two, or more than two. If you take away multiplicity, I am saying, and I'm interpreting this, you take away one at the same time. If we say one, or we say we dwell in oneness, you know, we're already making two. We're already making I am experiencing one, I am one. It's a little hard for the mind to wrap around, at least for mine. Oneness, when such dualities do not cease to exist, oneness itself cannot exist. It cannot. It can only exist in language. It's a language construct. So in that state, you know, self disappears, 10,000 things disappear, and one disappears. And that's why the next lines make sense. To this ultimate finality, no law or description applies. Now, this is not something we can think or grasp. What about this last line is helpful? You know, to this ultimate finality, no law or description applies. I'm kind of repeating myself here, but to me it reminds me of the central importance of letting go. Of letting go of thinking about how we can get there and what it is that we're aiming for. And finding a way instead to rest in without thinking. I come face to face with the difficulty of letting go when I try to apply it in Kung-on practice. You know, it's very hard to resist using cognition to try to figure out the answer to a Kung-on and instead rest with it and don't know. It's hard. I still have to work at that and not do that, you know, to really aim instead of aiming for the answer, to aim for don't know, aim for before thinking. Find a way to do that through some mind practice, through a meditation technique, for example, like mantra. You can rest with the question in a Kung-on. Rest with the question. But And I think Zhangbong Sunsa would confirm this because he and I have talked about this more than once. Really, to be open and not grasping for an answer. So that that an answer can appear without any grasping on our part. That's one of the benefits, really, of Kangen practice. It's this safe place, if you will, for setting aside our thinking and our, you know, our pride, maybe, and practicing not knowing in a very concrete way for a very particular purpose, you know, which is to use Kangen practice to develop insight and to strengthen our practice. Okay, well, suddenly I'm at the end. I think that's where I want to leave it today.